This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Let me start with a quote from the New York Times. Every Monday since April, thousands of North Carolina residents have gathered at the state capitol to protest the grotesque damage that a new Republican majority has been doing to a tradition of caring for the least fortunate. Now, granted, that wasn't a news article, but an editorial by the Times editorial board, but it demonstrates what many in North Carolina and elsewhere have been puzzling about all year and for much of the summer. After hundreds of years in the wilderness, state Republicans, who now control the state House and Senate, as well as the governor's office, have wasted no time in reversing the course of state government and redressing long-suffered grievances, or as Governor McCrory would say, fixing broken state government. The legislature has decided to cut off jobless benefits, saying that the state's generous program has dissuaded people from going back to work and helped to keep North Carolina as the state with the fifth highest unemployment rate in the country. They've cut back on spending for public schools, declined to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, repealed the Racial Justice Act, and are close to changing the income tax structure to a flat tax that some say benefits the rich on the backs of the poor. That's just a partial list of the breathtaking amount of legislation that has flown through the legislature in this session. And we'll spend this hour talking about these things and much of the rest of what's been going on with three people who have been following all this with keen interest. Dr. Eric Heberlig is Associate Professor of Political Science at UNC Charlotte, a frequent guest and our go-to guy last summer during the Democratic National Convention. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Mike.
Dr. Josh Putnam is a visiting assistant professor of political science at Davidson College. Thank you for being back with us.
Glad to be back here.
Now, both of these gentlemen are in our Spirit Square studio, while Rob Christensen joins us by phone from Raleigh, where he is a political columnist for the Raleigh News and Observer. Good morning, Rob.
Good morning.
Would it be accurate to describe what's been going on in Raleigh this session as a sea change? I'll start with the political scientist, Dr. Heberlig.
Yeah, absolutely. You see here a result of long-term pent-up demand from Republicans in the state of essentially being excluded from positions of power. Now they hold the majority of the House, the majority of the Senate, and the governorship, so they have free reign, and they also have veto-proof majorities in both houses of the legislature, which even limits the ability of a moderate Republican governor to put the brakes on.
Of course, if you are involved in precipitating the sea change, it's a good thing. If you're on the other side of the aisle, it's a terrible thing. Can these things, when you have such massive amounts of change at once, come back to bite you?
They can. In this instance, though, Republicans have done a masterful job in protecting themselves through redistricting for the better part of the next decade or so. So it's somewhat surprising, I suppose, that they're acting with such urgency. But I think that gets back to Eric's point before about not having had power since Reconstruction. So I want to act quickly on some initiatives that are happening elsewhere across the country in the South.
Dr. Putnam just used the word urgency, Rob, and it seems to me that if you have redistricted because of the census, which is what happened, and you've as a result come up with fairly protected districts where you're going to win for the next 10 years, why push all of this through in one session? Why the urgency to get this done and get it done now?
Well, first of all, it hasn't been just one session. They began essentially a conservative revolution last 2 years under Democrat, but they couldn't quite get it all through because they had a Democratic governor, Beth Perdue, and she could veto some pieces of the legislation, and I don't think they're through. I think there'll be more conservative pieces of this revolution in upcoming legislative sessions, assuming they maintain control. So it's an ongoing process. But I think we've seen the most of it this session. I think it is a sea change, and I think it's changed the whole political philosophy of what the legislature has tried to do. I mean, traditionally, this has been a poor state that has tried to industrialize over the last century, and North Carolina has had a very different approach from the rest of the South, and that is it has tried to modernize through more sophisticated. Most of the South has tried to industrialize through low taxes and less regulation. That's been the model through most of the South. North Carolina mainly driven by the Charlotte business community, by the way, which has been, always been a very forward-looking business community, has tried a more sophisticated approach. They said, no, we're not going that way. We're going to be a leader in the South, and we're going to have better roads. We're going to have a first-class university system. We're going to have research centers and that sort of thing. We're going to be a leader in the arts, and it's going to cost a little more money. And that's been the approach for since the 1920s, and since Cameron Morrison, and who was a Charlottean, who was governor, and so that's been the conversation, and that's why North Carolina got its progressive tradition in being a leader in education in the South and business. That model's changed this session, and so we no longer have the conversation. No one in Raleigh is talking about North Carolina being 46th right now, for example, in spending in public education. Everybody's talking about North Carolina needs to have the lowest taxes in the South to be competitive with South Carolina and Georgia. That's how the conversation has changed. And the model now is no longer do we need to keep up in education and keep up in roads, or at least that's not what's driving the conversation. What's driving the conversation is essentially taxes, and it's essentially a form, a spin-off of Reaganomics. In fact, they actually had Arthur Laffer, the father of Reaganomics, brought into the state to talk about this, and that is the philosophy as you cut taxes, it'll drive the economy, it'll revitalize the economy and address the state's high unemployment rate.
Well, let's back up, because if this is the whole new philosophy, how did the old philosophy work since Cameron Morrison? Were we successful? Did we achieve what we set out to achieve by being progressive in our outlook and taking care of education and taking care of roads and keeping taxes higher than the rest of the South? Or was it a failure that we're now trying to fix?
Well, that's part of the political debate. I think objectively, North Carolina has come a really long way. It was 100 years ago a very poor rural state, and it became it modernized and became the North Carolina we know today. And you can look around and decide for yourself. But having said that, it's obviously a state with a lot of problems, particularly in rural North Carolina, and particularly we've seen a hollowing out of the manufacturing base, particularly in small town and rural North Carolina, particularly in textiles and furniture and tobacco. And so there's a lot of hurt out there, which is why we have the fifth highest unemployment rate in the country. And so it worked pretty well. But
well, those jobs aren't coming back.
No, they're not.
And if you can lower taxes to zero, you can give money to manufacturers, and in some cases we do, and they're still not coming back. And at the same time they're talking about lowering taxes, they're talking about removing incentives for another industry that's here only because of the incentives, and that's the film industry. And I suppose it can be argued till you turn blue in the face on both sides of the equation that it's a good thing or it's a bad thing. But when you're keeping 75% of the money that they're bringing in and having to give back 25%, that seems like an interesting deal to me. I'd take it.
Well, I think that's part of the discussion, too, and one thing that Governor McCrory pushed in the campaign, which is exactly how do you go about economic development? Do you do it through giving out specific incentives to specific businesses you're trying to recruit, or do you try to change the overall benefits for everybody, including, you know, the traditional mom and pops that have been here who would benefit presumably more from a lower tax rate overall than a multi-million-dollar giveaway to somebody else to the state.
For the past 11 Mondays, there have been protests at the State House in Raleigh. They've come to be called Moral Mondays. How unusual is it for people in North Carolina to demonstrate like this, so many people for so long, at the legislature, or at any level for that matter?
Right. We haven't seen this, as I recall, much recently, not with such longevity or such staying power. So that's a new element to this that we just haven't seen in the past.
Are these all Democrats who are upset because what they've worked for 100 years is being overturned, or are there some Republicans mixed into this?
I don't know right off the top of my head. Okay. Rob may have a better answer to that.
Yeah, it's mainly Democrats. There's a few Republicans that are involved, but it's mainly a Democratic driven, not Democratic Party, but they're mainly Democrats that are involved. It's not only unusual in North Carolina; it's unprecedented, really, in North Carolina, unless you want to talk about the Civil Rights Movement or so forth. But it's unusual in the country. I mean, the parallel here is really the. What happened in Madison, Wisconsin, and that was really a labor-driven demonstrations when Governor Scott Walker proposed taking away the labor rights for public employees in Wisconsin. And that's why it has generated tons of national publicity, because it's unusual all across the country. What that speaks of is that even though we've had every indicator shows that this is a purple state. This is about as closely divided state and has been for a very long time as you can find in America. Every poll suggests that it can easily go Democratic, easily go Republican. And even though the state has moved, the public leadership has moved the state sharply to the right, there is no indication in the polls that the population has moved sharply to the right. So the population is where it has always been. It's a kind of a middling population. And so there are a lot of people that are unhappy with this sharp shift to the right. And so, in another state, you could have moved to the legislature sharp to the right, and there wouldn't have been this blowback as we had in North Carolina. But because the state is closely divided, you've gotten this tremendous counter reaction.
So is this an indication that redistricting, which we went through as a result of the census, was more along the lines of gerrymandering as opposed to simple redistricting?
Well, it was a gerrymander, and of course the Democrats have done it for years, and mm-hmm. the Republicans have essentially gotten better at it, partly because it's become more sophisticated with computers and so forth. And so we had a situation where we had the last election, for example, in the congressional races, we had more people voting for Democratic candidates, but we had only 13 congressional seats. I think we had only four Democrats elected, even though more people voted Democrat. So that's really the result of very clever drawing of district lines. So that gets to the question: is what's the political upshot of this? And the polls all show that the legislature is very unpopular. But as the guests noted earlier, it's almost certain that the Republicans will retain control of the legislature in 2014 because they have drawn very favorable districts. So what might be the political implications of this? And I think what's likely is that there are some districts that will be in play. They tend to be districts that are held by moderate Republicans in suburban districts. If there is a backlash, that some suburban Republicans will lose their seats, and it will not be the red hot conservatives that will lose their seats. It'll be the more moderate Republicans that will lose their seats.
So, for you guys who are political scientists, would you agree with that? And would you agree that these Moral Monday protests are not going to have any effect on the legislation floating through the legislature, but they may only have an effect at election time in end of next year?
Yeah, I agree with both of those. And I think an added point here is that the type of Republicans that are being elected, whether they've rigged the districts or not, are different than in the past. You don't see, kind of country club, chamber of commerce type Republicans or Democrats. These are highly ideological mm-hmm. people. They're people who are inexperienced in governing. So without that experience, they don't know why the policies have been constructed the way they have. They don't necessarily anticipate the unintended consequence and don't care the unintended consequences of changing the policy.
Question is, should they care if they're voting their conscience? Should they care?
Sure, because the policies have real effect on real people.
Okay, we have to take a break. We're going to come back with more of our conversation about what's going on in Raleigh, the impact of Moral Mondays, and some of the things that the legislature has been doing, the bills they're passing and trying to pass, with Dr. Eric Heberlig and Dr. Josh Putnam from UNC Charlotte and Davidson College, and Rob Christensen with the Raleigh News and Observer. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Cleveland County Arts Council, hosting the 14th annual Reel to Reel International Film Festival, July 24th through the 27th at the Joy Performance Theater in Kings Mountain. ccartscouncil.org. Well, of all the musicians in the world, few have the kind of success that snags them an appearance on David Letterman. Fewer still have an opportunity like that who put their careers on hold to go back to school. But Vienna Tang did, and she has now finished school and returned to the music business. And this singer, songwriter, pianist joins us tomorrow to talk about that journey and share some of her music. And then a closer look at the state of the arts and arts funding in Charlotte. That's all tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, President Obama replaced two nominees to the National Labor Relations Board in a concession to Republican senators, politics, policymaking, and the NLRB.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Dr. Eric Heberlig, Associate Professor of Political Science at UNC Charlotte, Dr. Josh Putnam, Visiting Assistant Professor of Political Science at Davidson College, and Rob Christensen, Political Columnist with the Raleigh News and Observer. We're talking about what's going on in Raleigh. I read that quote at the very beginning of the program from the New York Times editorial that described the damage being done here as grotesque. I suppose if you are a liberal, I assume that the New York Times editorial board leans that way, that grotesque might be an accurate description, but was it a fair description, Dr. Josh Putnam?
Grotesque is like beauty, right? It's in the eye of the beholder. And in this instance, folks that are protesting on Moral Mondays probably are of the same opinion as the New York Times editorial board. However, if you're on the other side of the aisle, if you're the chairman of the Republican Party here in the state, Claude Pope, then you take issue with some of the things that the Times had to say.
And they said that. I think they used that word because they say that a lot of these new laws and policies are designed to benefit business and the rich over the rank and file citizen. Again, accurate or fair?
Probably accurate and fair in describing that. Again, going back to Eric's point from before the break, that we were talking about a different breed of Republican that's in charge or in the majority in Raleigh these days.
They've been described by protesters on Moral Mondays as being mean-spirited. Accurate or fair?
Oh, I would think the Republicans would argue that they're not mean-spirited, but I don't think they'd take issue with the fact that their policies are designed to benefit business and upper-income taxpayers. They would argue that that's exactly what we need, that we need the money going to investors, to people who are going to create the jobs.
This is trickle-down economics.
Yes.
Redux. Did it work in the Reagan years, or was it disproved by the Clinton years?
Well, again, I suspect that it depends on the eye of the beholder, that Republicans will point to the years of economic growth during the Reagan administration. Liberals will point to the Clinton administration. If you look at the evidence over a broader period of time, at least at the federal level, tax rates have very little impact on the growth of the economy.
The Times described the cruelest decision by lawmakers, their words, as ending federal unemployment benefits for 70,000 residents, 100,000 coming online in the next few months, this in a state with the fifth highest unemployment in the country. Why did they do this? If we have the fifth highest unemployment rate, there are a lot of people who don't have jobs. Ending their extended benefits, which were described someplace as being generous, when you look at what they were getting, I would hardly think that it was generous, but you can't live on it. But why would they do it?
We had a debt to the federal government.
$2.5 billion.
And the deal that was worked out was that there would be a small increase in unemployment taxes paid by business owners and a larger cut from the beneficiaries in order to balance out the unemployment benefit debt that we had. And that debt, of course, was driven by the fact that there's been a large recession throwing lots of people out of work, which drew a lot of money out of the system, and the fact that, I guess, 10 or 15 years ago, the state legislature had cut unemployment taxes in North Carolina, which meant there was less money sitting in the system to be drawn upon when we have a recession.
And Dr. John Connaughton, from UNC Charlotte, who was our guest last week, an economist, said essentially they just decided to cut off the debt, to stop incurring increasing debt while they tried to pay off the $2.5 billion to the federal government. But he also said that these were viewed and are viewed and could be argued that they were a disincentive to go back to work, because if you're making $535 a week in unemployment, you're not going to take a job that doesn't pay at least $600. Really?
Well, that's economic theory, I suppose, or one economic theory. Again, that's an argument that's been made on one side of the aisle, not on the other. that these enticements, I suppose, are disincentives to go back to work. Now, whether that's actually the case, we don't necessarily see that in the data and the research that's been done in that area.
Plus, there don't seem to be a lot of jobs flooding back into the state, so it seems like it looks like on the surface that you are inflicting pain on people who can least afford to have that pain inflicted. Rob,
beyond a theory, it's a political mindset that people are freeloading off the system.
Okay.
Now, whether that's true or not, there is a widespread belief among a lot of Republican conservatives that people are simply freeloading, that they're not looking hard enough for work, or they're not taking the best available job. Now, whether that's true or not, you can put that up online and see, and you can get all kinds of comments both sides of that. But that there is a strong belief that that's the case, and among a lot of Republican conservatives, and I think that's behind some of their decisions.
Could this affect them at the vote? Inflicting pain on voters in an off year is one thing. Will it be remembered next year, and will it have an impact next year?
Yeah, I think the challenge is that the poor voters, low-educated voters, are the least likely to participate. And since they disproportionately vote for the Democrats, Republicans don't particularly care that they're kicking them. It's not the constituency that they feel responsible to answering to. And with the gerrymandered districts, it's really the what's going to hurt the Republicans, if anything, is if independents decide that the Republicans have gone too far and want to send them a message to shape up.
One thing we hadn't talked about in terms of political fallout is the 2014 U.S. Senate race. And although that doesn't affect the legislative races as such, the likely Republican candidate is either going to be House Speaker Tom Tillis or Senate Leader Phil Berger. And while the Republican, and this is going to be one of the high-profile Senate races in the country in the battle for control of the United States Senate, so there'll be lots of money spent. Now, the Republicans want to make Democratic Senator Kay Hagan the focus of the race and tie her into President Obama and Obamacare, et cetera, et cetera. But whoever the Republican candidate is, particularly if they're connected with the legislature, will make all these legislative issues the centerpiece. And so if it's very difficult to elect a Democrat to the United States Senate in North Carolina. It tends to lean red on U.S. Senate races. So if Kay Hagan should win and either Tillis or Berger should go down defeat, that could have a chastening effect on the legislature, particularly if they lose some seats. So even if the legislature doesn't flip, and it's very, as we've talked about, it's unlikely to flip, there could be a message sent that could have an effect on future legislatures if Republicans lose seats and if they lose the U.S. Senate race, and which legislative issues are key to the election.
North Carolina ranks 46th among the 50 states in terms of money per capita spent on education, and we are spending less on schools now than we did in 2007, even as the state population has continued to grow, which means that per capita spending is going down. Legislation has also eliminated funding for pre-kindergarten teaching slots. So what's the thinking behind this in a state that's trying to attract business and saying out of one side of its mouth that to get business to come here, we have to offer educated workers who can be trained quickly and easily and who are of a certain level of competence coming into this, while at the same time you're weakening the educational system? What's the thinking behind this?
Well, it's kind of a chicken or the egg sort of proposition, right? Their objective up front, I think, is to make the state business friendly. So the news today with the passage, I guess, the bill's McCrory's signature away from becoming law to lower the tax rates, North Carolina suddenly drops from 44th to somewhere in the mid-teens in terms of its business-friendly climate. You know, if you're of a Republican mindset, potentially that's the first step in all of this. And you can, you know, once the economy improves and so on and so forth, you're able to potentially address some of the concerns on education rather than, say, education first and vice versa.
Education's a long-term thing. It takes students 18 years to, yeah. well, not 18, 15 years or so to get through K through 12, and you know another four to get through college. So that's
but we keep that's another
generation of legislators' problem.
But we keep hearing that pre-K education, particularly for minority and underprivileged children, is critical to their development and preparing them for first through fifth grade. And if you lose them in the fourth grade, they're gone. That seems short-sighted to me.
Arguably, yes. But again, that's. You know, pre-K has never been terribly popular with Republicans. They think that's families' responsibilities. So it's they've been trying for years to merge the two pre-K programs that North Carolina has and cut back on the number of slots that are available.
The Affordable Care Act, at least for now, is scheduled to go into effect in January, but the legislature has declined to expand Medicaid as part of that plan, even though the funding for this, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, was coming from Washington, correct? That means that a lot of people are going to fall through the cracks when this thing goes into effect, if in fact it goes into effect, because Republicans in Washington are trying to reverse it as well. Is this simply Republicans in the legislature making an ideological statement that plays well with the base? We're not going to be involved in participating in this new paradigm. And will this cost the state money in the long run? Because these people have to seek medical care by going to emergency rooms, which we've been told repeatedly is the highest cost of medical care anywhere, period.
Their argument is that the long-term cost in North Carolina is the federal government guarantees a high level of reimbursement for the Medicaid expansion until 2020, I think. After that, there's no guarantee, and they fear that that's going to be shifted to the state. Even if that doesn't happen, you know, healthcare costs are a large and growing proportion of the state budget anyway, so they have reason to be concerned. Although I think it's mainly an ideological and anti-Obama issue that's driving their response.
How big an issue is this for the people at the Moral Monday protests, Rob?
Well, it's one of several issues. It's certainly one of the key issues, but it's just one of a laundry list of issues. But getting back to your earlier question on business competitiveness, you know, the Republicans are looking at the whole issue of business competitiveness from a narrow gauge point of view, and that is tax rates. But you know, there's a lot of ways of looking at this, and so there's a lot of ratings and so forth on business competitiveness that various national organizations put out. And they often include things like education and roads and all these other things that companies look at because they have to put their employees in a location. They're not looking at just tax rates. And North Carolina often comes out in the top 10 in business-friendly environments. When national groups look at these ratings. But this does not seem to compute with a Republican legislature because they discount things like education and all these other factors when they look at business friendliness and are looking at solely from a tax issue. And again, it goes back to what is important to the core Republican principles. And Reaganomics has become essentially the sacred text for the Republican Party, and it trumps everything. So every conversation you hear from Republican leaders here in Raleigh, from the governor and everything, you never hear them cite, oh, North Carolina is 46th in education. What are we going to do about this? How are we going to address this? We got to address this down the road. You never hear that. But you hear over and over and over again, oh, my gosh, South Carolina's corporate taxes are lower than North Carolina, or Georgia's taxes are lower. You hear that constantly. Mm-hmm. That's their entire focus is on taxes, but you never hear them say, "Well, such and such a state is putting more into their schools than North Carolina." You never hear that.
You guys teach political science, and obviously a part of political science is looking back at policies and procedures and how things unfolded in the past. We've been having this conversation about taxes versus other things for 40 years or more. Is there any historical evidence that one side is right and the other is wrong?
Well, I think, you know, we mentioned Bill Clinton earlier. Arkansas was really a basket case, you know, the epitome of, you know, the old South in terms of economic and educational backwardness. The reason Clinton got on the national stage as a potential presidential candidate is, like Jim Hunt in North Carolina, he said, to get ourselves out of it, we need to invest in education, and that's going to you know, allow us to attract a different type of business to Arkansas, or in Hunt's case, to North Carolina, and attract businesses a different type of way, people that's going to draw higher paying, more educated citizens that'll help build the communities here, not just, appreciate the tax rates.
Many states in the South, Mississippi comes to mind almost immediately, Alabama, maybe rural Georgia, you think of them not having very good educational systems. I think Mississippi is 50th in education, but they probably do have very low taxes. What's the per capita income in those states for the people who live there and pay taxes and vote?
Probably very low, but I think the difference here is that, you know, in rural North Carolina, because of the hits that manufacturing has taken, you know, those aren't terribly hopeful places. The benefits of the type of policies we've talked about have largely accrued to, Raleigh, Charlotte, the Research Triangle, which is great for those places, but
there are all
not
those,
for the
all
places
the, all
represented.
All of those places that you've mentioned are progressive areas of the state.
Exactly.
Many Democratic-leaning and certainly focused on education and high-tech, and they seem to be successful. Those three places are the economic engine of the state. Why would you turn your back on that kind of track record and try to take the state in a different direction?
Well, again, it gets back to the point that Rob made before about the pressure exerted on North Carolina from other states that to move forward, again, given a certain mindset, you need lower business-friendly taxes. It's akin to what we saw in terms of kind of lottery diffusion across the South, that Georgia didn't have a lottery. Georgia citizens were crossing the borders into Florida to buy lottery tickets. Mm-hmm. All that money's going to Florida. Mm-hmm. Georgia adopts a lottery. South Carolina adopts a lottery. Finally, North Carolina, very much further down the road, adopts its lottery among the last states in the South to do so. So that mindset's the same. And again, these are not Republican constituents that we're talking about, poor rural folks. You may have some rural folks that are Republicans, but these aren't the folks that Republicans are catering to right now.
We'll take a look at some of the other things that have been going on, some of the other policies and legislative reforms that have been put forth by the legislature and passed. And I want to share a bunch of emails and a couple of phone calls from people who have been holding on for quite a while. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Lenore Ryan University graduate programs offering master's degrees in a variety of disciplines from the Hickory, Asheville, and Columbia, South Carolina campuses. Details at lr.edu/graduate. President Barack Obama replaced two nominees to the National Labor Relations Board in a concession to Republican senators. Politics, policymaking, and the NLRB, the topic of the conversation in 20 minutes on the Diane Rehm Show. We, of course, are talking about politics in North Carolina, particularly with an eye toward the legislature and all the goings-on up there, with Moral Mondays and all the things that the Moral Monday protesters are protesting and some that they're not. And we will continue that conversation in a moment. You can join it at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks and other ways as well.
Hi, it's us, Click and Clack from Car Talk. Hey, Tommy, I finally found something worthwhile to do with your old cars.
Really?
And it doesn't involve Boston Harbor and a trunk full of bricks. Get this, donate your old car today, and we'll turn it into Morning Edition Fresh Air and Car Talk tomorrow.
That's fast.
Well, in your case, we need to move quickly before your car turns to dust. Donate now, you'll get a tax deduction, and we'll even tow it away for free.
Call 1-866-789-8627.
Hey, Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about what's been going on this summer and the last several years in the North Carolina legislature now that the Republicans are in charge and have all three branches. Well, I guess they don't – we can't say the Supreme Court, but we have two houses and the governor's the gubernatorial office taken by Republicans. Dr. Josh Putnam is with us on our in our studio, visiting assistant professor of political science at Davidson College. Dr. Eric Heberlig, associate professor of political science at UNC Charlotte, and Rob Christensen, a political columnist with the Raleigh News and Observer. Many emails have come in during this conversation. Let me share a few with you. Michael emails, growing up here in the 60s and 70s, I didn't really understand people's antipathy to carpetbaggers. Senator Rusho is clearing that up for me. I fail to understand why my fellow Southerners are so willing to have a Massachusetts dentist distort their state to his specifications. John emails, I'm a lifelong Republican who is infuriated by my party. The redrawn districts are a joke. I will never have a candidate that I can vote for again. And the argument that the Democrats did it before, well, my mom taught me that two wrongs do not make a right. Hail the new Republicans, party of the rich, and forget everyone else. That's from somebody who identifies themselves as a Republican. Jamie in Laurinburg emails, what time do Moral Mondays take place exactly? The answer to that would be what? All day? Pretty much? And into the evening?
5 p.m.
Till 5 p.m.?
No, they start at 5 p.m.
They start at 5 p.m. Why do they start so late? Are they not in session until 5 p.m.?
They come in session like around 7 o'clock, but the rallies, they start out as rallies and then outdoor rallies, and then the few people who want to engage in civil disobedience later do that. So, but they start out as large rallies, usually a couple thousand people, and then however many, a couple dozens or whatever, later decide to go inside and get arrested. So, but they start at 5 p.m. outside the legislature.
Okay. Another Michael emails, during your previous discussion with Dr. Connaughton, he talked about the debt incurred by unemployment. Nobody ever mentions part of the whole came from reducing the unemployment payments from employers. Well, you did, Dr. Heberglue, a few minutes ago.
But I'm nobody.
As for this being due to an economic theory, these are the same people that also believe Jesus rode around on dinosaurs. David in Charlotte couldn't hold. He said North Carolina Republicans remind him of the government in Atlas Shrugged. That's an Ayn Rand book with the addition of how they try to control women's bodies. That is what this is about, isn't it? And for many of these far right-wing people, they are followers of Ayn Rand's philosophy, are they not?
Arguably, yeah, that it's the very minimalist government, that government is always coercive, always a risk, and therefore the less it does, the better. And I think your questions regarding education kind of point to that arguably education is the best chance to long term of improving a state's economic condition, yet they see, because they're public schools, they must be run incorrectly, so we need vouchers, we need more private schools, and we need to defund the public schools.
And Ayn Rand wrote about all this in Atlas Shrugged, which is a novel. What other political credentials did Ayn Rand have?
None that I'm aware of. I know she has certainly ran in conservative circles, fiscal conservative circles, and small government circles in her heyday. And it's certainly that during this the evolution of this libertarian streak that has, I shouldn't say taken over the Republican Party, but certainly evolved in the last few years with the rise of the Tea Party. It's something that has raised her profile somewhat.
Well, this is where we get a little confused by this, because the libertarian streak seems to say that government stay out, leave me alone. And yet some of these Republicans are doing the opposite. Abortion comes to mind, and the House voted 74-41 along party lines to approve new rules for abortion clinics. Proponents say the new rules would make the procedures safer for women. Opponents say it is a blatant attempt to shut down clinics and curb a woman's right to choose. Now, we've gone through this debate in this country for years, and I've had people sit on this panel, and I've heard them on national television shows say abortion is something that will never be handled, because it makes for great red meat talking points on both sides of the aisle during election years, and it's part of the third rail of politics. Don't touch it, because a whole constituency will be up in arms against you if you do. Obviously, they don't believe that anymore.
Yeah, again, you have a different type of Republican in office, ones who are ideologically committed to this. The voters they talk to are strongly believe in this, so they see no downside in addressing it. And I think the interesting dynamic here is that, you know, you have the governor who was clear in his commitments, who decided that, you know, vetoing this bill wasn't worth the pain it would cause him from his Republican base. And he, given that they had the votes probably to override a veto, he would look even weaker by vetoing it and then losing.
Are all Republican women pro-life, or are some of them?
Certainly not.
Are there a significant number who would be pro-choice?
I don't know about significant. Again, that's not.
Are there enough people on the fence, enough women on the fence politically, who are pro-choice, who might take offense?
Well, again, that's where the gray area in this issue is, right? Is that if we talk about it in the extreme form, that either we're against or we're for, we're missing a lot of the gray area in between, and that's where most people fall on that
right.
issue. So, depending on what the specifics are of any given proposal going through a legislature or just in the court of public opinion, the feelings on that are apt to be different.
And that's exactly why the Republicans are trying to frame it as an issue of health. Protecting women's health, not an issue of restricting access to abortion. And McCrory's attempt at a compromise was, the Department of Health and Human Services says that the original bill would have some problems in it. So the legislature says, all right, well, then you figure out the health rules. And, you know, we don't particularly care about working out the details. You do it. And we'll pass it over to the executive
branch. We're not the only state dealing with this. A lot of Republican-controlled legislatures are taking a backdoor entrance into this battle against Roe v. Wade. Are we witnessing laws around the country that will be challenged at the Supreme Court level, given the earlier – and perhaps challenged successfully, given the earlier Roe v. Wade decision, which was unanimous by the Supreme Court?
Right. And again, that discussion of the unanimity of that decision came up in the recent gay marriage discussion on the court as well, in terms of at least the outside discussion about an overreach on that particular issue. Back to the abortion issue, though, again, we talk a lot about these gray areas, and this is happening in a lot of other states, and that by design, in some ways, is to challenge Roe versus Wade. That's been a given ever since that decision came down in the early 70s.
I think one point could be made here is that the redistricting has led to these very polarized districts that are either very Republican or very Democrat, so that these legislators no longer have to appeal to the middle. And so therefore it is safe for Republican legislators to push, for example, anti-abortion legislation without fearing to alienate middle-of-the-road voters, since there are so few middle-of-the-road voters in their districts. They're either heavily Republican or heavily Democrat.
This speaks to how we redistrict, not just in North Carolina, but around the country. Is this something – of course, I don't know how you would do this, because politicians have a vested interest in the outcome of how redistricting occurs around the country. Is it time for a national conversation about this? Because if the middle, which is the great bulk of the voter and the great bulk of citizens, if the middle is being ignored so that the parties can play to the extreme left and extreme right of their constituencies, and they can successfully do this because of redistricting, is it time to look at redistricting and how we do it?
Now, other states, a few, use nonpartisan redistricting commissions to try to address this, but again, that requires the General Assembly to act. One reform I thought was particularly interesting this year, California instituted, which allows the top two vote-getters in the primary, regardless of party, to advance. So it's a safe Democratic district. You can have two Democrats in the general election. That gives then one of the Democrats incentive to appeal to Republican and independent voters, hopefully with the election then of a more moderate strand of Democrats. So I think that's an interesting reform to consider.
Let's talk about voting. Legislation requiring voter ID is temporarily on hold in the Senate. The House has already acted on it. The legislature is also contemplating an end to early voting, Sunday voting, and same-day registration. Now, in past elections, more than 1.2 million Democrats voted during the 17 days of early voting. Only 800,000 Republicans did. And some say that both of these measures are a Republican attempt to disenfranchise Democrats and poor people. Is that what the result of this would be if they successfully ended early voting, Sunday voting, and added voter ID?
The folks who are affected by this are disproportionately Democratic. So, again, lower-income voters, typically minority voters, it would have that effect.
But couldn't they just vote absentee if they couldn't be there on Election Day?
There are other options. Absentee is one of them that just requires, again, if the idea is to make it more convenient for folks to vote, as has been the case over the last 10, 15 years or so with the evolution of early voting, this scales that back to somewhat. It makes it less convenient.
According to Slate magazine, every political move taken by the new Republican legislature since 2011 has been aimed at packing liberals and black voters into as few districts as possible, creating a conservative majority for, they hope, at least a decade. Agree with that?
Yeah. I mean, again, that gets back to the one of the very first points we made today,
right.
Which is that the Republican Party, once it took control, was able to do a very, very good job of redistricting using computers and so on and so forth, like Rob mentioned before.
Taxes. We've talked a little bit about taxes, and we are working. They're working toward, I don't know whether it's tax reform or it's just tax change at the legislature, but they increased the gasoline tax to 37.6 cents a gallon. We already had a pretty doggone high gasoline tax in North Carolina as it was. If we're fighting for lower to be the least taxed state in the nation, why, or at least in the South, why would you raise the gasoline tax, particularly when gasoline prices are rising as well?
Consumers pay that, not businesses.
Businesses don't pay gasoline tax at the pump?
Not directly very much. You know, trucking companies do, but pretty much the others.
Yeah,
that's not a large proportion of their expenses.
All of that's passed on. If FedEx or UPS has to buy gasoline, and they do in North Carolina, if a private company delivers a desk to your office because you bought it at their and they're delivering it in their truck, they have to buy gasoline to drive the truck. They're paying that tax, and they're passing it on to
yeah.
you.
Yeah, they're paying it, but it's not a very large proportion of their total expenses.
Okay. So anyway, we've got the tax going up on gasoline. The legislation, they want to change the income tax system. That legislation includes cuts in income taxes for both corporations and individuals, all individual rates falling to 5.8% and corporate tax rates falling to 6% and potentially to 5% in 2015. It's a flat tax, and the Business Journal says it reduces tax burdens most dramatically for upper income taxpayers. It also increases the standard deduction, however, for everybody, and that would benefit to mid to lower income taxpayers. So, if this passes, what would the impact ultimately be? Does anybody know?
Well, I think that the biggest impact it has is it lowers the amount of revenue that's coming into the state pretty substantially. So, the education cuts that we've talked about already, that's a pretty big percentage of total state spending. So, it's hard to see any increases in education spending, transportation spending, or anything else.
But they want to raise.
When you lower the total revenue
stream.
But
they want to, well, are they going to lower the total revenue stream, or are they going to turn around and pass the taxes on services, which we currently do not pay, sales taxes on services?
Well, that was part of the debate, and they explicitly decided not to do that.
Okay. The airport. Let's talk about the airport. It would be understandable, at least to many people, I suppose, if legislators from other parts of the state had suggested and pushed for Charlotte Douglas International Airport to be removed from the control of the city of Charlotte and put it into the hands of an authority. It becomes a little more difficult to understand why the Mecklenburg County delegation would be leading the charge, but Republicans on the delegation did. Is this simply a matter of state-level Republicans punishing the democratically controlled city of Charlotte?
That's a good question. Again, it's akin to what we're talking about in terms of the New York Times, kind of giving a prescription for what should and shouldn't happen in North Carolina. This is that on a smaller scale. It's folks in Raleigh kind of pushing this on folks here. And again, there is that partisan component to
this. Explain this to me, because at the national level, Republicans are most often associated with states' rights and state control. States are in a better position to make decisions than the federal government. Here you have an instance of Republicans in the legislature saying the state is better able to make a decision than you, the city that's run this airport for 70 years.
Well, and I also think it's an issue of that it's an independent authority who presumably they want businessmen to be appointed to this to run the legislature. So it's
businesses with airport experience.
Yeah,
who would they be?
People with connections to U.S. Air, presumably. So yeah, it's the general philosophy that business people always know what they're doing and can make better decisions than government.
One of the arguments, and very quickly because we're running short of time, one of the arguments was that former Charlotte city manager made some comment that alluded to the fact that perhaps the city, which has never done this, might take revenues from the airport and apply them to other things, and that got them all riled up. And they said, we can't do this. There's a danger in that. But somebody at the legislature said, well, we could take some of this money from the airport and give it to other jurisdictions around the state. What's the difference?
Hard to see.
Yeah.
All right. And why is the mayor, not the mayor, the governor, why is the governor, the former Charlotte mayor, not, because this would have riled him up.
He'd have been very mad.
Why has he not said anything?
It's easier to stay out of it right now. Yeah.
Politically.
Yeah.
He's got a different constituency now.
Okay, I wish we had more time because I've got a lot more things to talk about. We are out of time. Rob Christensen, political columnist with the Raleigh News and Observer, thank you for joining us from Raleigh. Dr. Josh Putnam, visiting assistant professor of political science at Davidson College, and Dr. Arab Heberlig, associate professor of political science at UNC Charlotte. Thank you all for the hour.